Hi, this is Icon Art Radio with Alan Cobb, Donna Colby, and me, Bill Teeple. And we're broadcasting here from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa at Icon Gallery. And we have our special guest today, Judy Bales, whose exhibit is opening at Icon on the First Friday Art Walk, August 1st. Well, give us a little glimpse of what's coming before we loop back onto your entire life. Because okay. Donna will want to know about that.
Okay. The works that I'm creating for this show, I refer to as metal fabrics. I loosely refer to them that way. Often in the past, I've worked in three-dimensional sculptural forms. For this particular show, everything will be on the wall, and I believe everything will be metal. There may be some fabric in some pieces, but mostly it's metal, and I work with metal in fiber processes. So I use metal as if it's a yarn or thread. And so these pieces are basically assembling bits of metal that, or found metals or whatever, that create a cloth or a fabric-like structure. And so they'll be displayed that way on the walls as if they were large yardages or quilts or something that was actually made of fiber.
And this will spread throughout the entire gallery.
That's correct. Now, up in the
mezzanine, we call it.
The mezzanine, yes. I will have some smaller pieces. And so there will be a slightly different, that's a smaller space and a slightly different flavor to that space. And the lower gallery will have these very expansive pieces, which are, in fact, all made up of small units. So that's the way I do construct these fabric pieces, is out of many, many small pieces. And that's mostly for practical reasons. I'm not able to transport them, or I don't have a big enough studio to work on them if it was just one very solid piece. So that also kind of lends to the idea of a fabric, because a fabric is something that you can compress down, you can fold it up, or you can layer it and put it into a smaller space, and then you take it out and it can cover a very large area.
Now, did you study fabric art, or what did you study in school?
Well, I started out as a painter, as a painting major, and got my bachelor's degree in painting. And then by the time there was quite a long break between my undergraduate work and my graduate school. And by the time I went to graduate school, I actually went back in fiber. Or there it was called, at the University of Georgia, it was called fabric design. Now all art departments refer to that field as fiber, and that just covers anything that has to do with fabric structure, like weaving, knitting. I mean, anything that you would create an actual fabric out of. And the other part of that is surface design, or you know, that could be printing or dyeing or all the different ways that you would then embellish the surface of a fabric. So that was kind of the way the department was broken down. But my painting background really, I never was a weaver. I never was a person that was really into fabric design. I just got interested in the process, and I brought my, I still look at myself basically as a painter, just in the way I approach my work. And so that I really brought that into the fiber studies in graduate school.
Well, and I think we're going to appreciate that in this particular show, because you're going to be working with the illusory field of the wall, because you've got space created in an illusory way with a wall, and then you've got three-dimensional real stuff coming out, and I'm very much looking forward to it. And some of the pictures, the advanced photos that you sent, the one solid field. It's not weaving through. I think it's the other one. There's a copper thing.
A copper assemblage.
And then
there's
weaving through or something.
And there's one titled weave through. Right.
Well, that's the one that knocks my... That's because I am a painter, uh-huh. and as a field with an overall field of shapes playing against each other and repeating patterns, and but a spatial thing going on, and it's like a Bach or something. It's like looking at Bach.
And that's interesting because some of the pieces in this show will probably be about half and half divided between very dense solid forms like that one, I mean, where you don't see through the material. And the other, probably about another 50%, will be very airy. And either you can actually see through the actual material, such as aluminum screen. There's one large piece that will be created from aluminum screening. Or there will be interstices in the construction process so that you're seeing the wall through.
And I love the pieces where you see the filmy, flowy, and then the wall. The blank spaces of the wall, and it creates these are fantastic.
Thank you. I'm sorry.
What I've seen.
I'm burning with curiosity about a number of things, but one thing is to go back. I'd like to find out what prompted you originally to work with the kinds of materials that, you know, these sort of utilitarian metal materials and plastics and everything that you work with. That's like one facet of the question, and the other is, did this have roots in your childhood? Did you go around finding things and making things when you were a little kid?
Well, interestingly, I think until I was in college, I was pretty oriented toward realism in painting and drawing, and my father was not an artist, but he could have been. He chose something else for economic reasons, but he was an excellent draftsman, and he really instilled that kind of thing in me, that, you know, you really have to be good at drafting and drawing and all of those aspects of realism. So I actually carried that into, so I wasn't very loose, I was very tight, as in undergraduate school, that was the description of, it was a very good thing if as a painter you were loose. I don't even know what they say in college now, but you know, if you were tight, it was not such a good thing. So I was very, very tight. And actually I am quite a good draftsperson. But then after getting my degree, for practical reasons, I went back and got a teaching certificate, as many people do, many artists do. And I taught in public schools for 3 years. And I taught a year of high school, and then I taught 2 years of elementary. And that's actually the changing point in my exploration of materials, because it was the influence of those children and the way they worked. And I was teaching in a very poor county in rural Georgia, and there was very little money for art materials, so I had to find materials, and so I just salvaged materials. And there actually was a woman principal at that school who was very supportive of the arts, and she was really inventive and helpful about bringing me materials if she found, you know, some huge amount of telephone wire or. Gosh, I can't even remember all the things that we would use. But, you know, just anything that you can find in mass that you can give out to, you know, 800 children, which would come through my art class within a week. Mm. And seeing the way they attacked those materials and what they did with them, I think that was actually what broke me out of my very, my much tighter way of working. And so then, by the time I went back to graduate school, I took a summer's course to update my teaching certificate, and instead of the yarn and all the, it was in fiber, and I think it was a basic textile structure course, but I found that instead of using the yarn, I would go to a hardware store and get wire or get plumber's chain or something like that. I got real fascinated by other materials, and the instructor that I had was very supportive of that. So that series of events kind of got me started in working that way, and then I chose to go back to graduate school and study under that particular person, Glenn Kaufman at the University of Georgia. And then since then, I've been through many. I've moved from flat things or things that are fiber works that are more clearly two-dimensional, and then sometimes for a number of years, my work will tend to be almost totally sculptural or three-dimensional, and it seems to be very cyclical. There's a kind of a, throughout the years, there's been an underlying influence of quilting on my work, and especially of African-American quilting, and I gave a talk at Odd Thursdays not too long ago on that, and relating to that is I also have been heavily influenced by African as well as African-American, and I recently had this, well, just 2 weeks ago, I had this absolutely fabulous trip to Washington, D.C. to visit museums, and I was really fortunate to have that trip funded by the Iowa Arts Council for a visual research trip. And one of the main exhibits that I went to see was at the Museum of African Art, and it's a exhibition of work by the artist El Anatsui, who's a Nigerian artist, or from Ghana, I'm not sure which. But he's quite famous now, and he does these absolutely huge, he was a sculptor, but what he's become known for in recent years are these absolutely dazzling, huge fabrics that are made from the metal bands of liquor bottles that that he can salvage in the area where he lives and works. And there are many social and political undercurrents to his work that was really interesting to read about when I saw the exhibit. But mostly the dominant thing for me is the way they hit me on a visual level. And they're absolutely, as I say, they're just dazzling. You know, he takes these castaway bits of metal and with studio assistance, he puts together these cloths that are, some of the biggest ones are maybe, I'd say, 20 feet by, they're like a huge curtain of these finely wired together metal pieces. And it's an interesting thing because I've been working with metal for years, and then recently I saw his work in one of my fiber magazines, and I realized, oh, that really relates to what I'm doing now. And then I started looking up his work and found out that there was this huge show of his, and I've seen two of his pieces, made trips to see them in Kansas City. And then I realized that his work is all over the world, and everybody's heard about him. And it's just an interesting thing that has to do with where influence comes from, or the fine line between being influenced by a person's work and discovering a person's work that relates to your work, mm-hmm. and then being more influenced by that person, and where does it begin? You know, had I seen his work somewhere that it didn't register consciously, or was I just working in this way and then I happened to notice his work and realize mm-hmm. that there's a lot of not that my work looks like his, but there are just many in terms of the construction and just the visual idea, there's definitely a relationship. So that's something I think that probably all of us as artists have to think about and just wonder, you know, where do our influences come from, and how much of a collective consciousness is there in terms of trends in art, or when do certain trends in art spring up simultaneously in different parts of the world or different parts of the country, and why is that? Not that it really changes the way I work, but it's it's just something that one starts wondering about.
Well, we're interconnected. Yeah. I mean, it's a fact that this happens. So we're obviously interconnected in more ways than we even realize.
I've been involved in
but let me just say one thing. For everyone out there, this is Icon Art Radio on KRUU LPFM, and we're interviewing Judy Bales, whose art show is opening at Icon Gallery on August 1st. Go ahead, Alan.
Took the words right out of my mouth.
Oh. Well, it's good for people listening to know who they're listening to.
Absolutely, yeah. No, I was just responding to your you know, notion of kind of the collective consciousness, because I've been involved in inventing and consumer product development and things off and on over the years, and I'm always trying to invent something that, you know, could pay the rent. And at least three times, I would say, I've come up with some really very timely and appropriate ideas that would have translated nicely into commercial products. And as I began to develop the idea within usually just a few months, I would discover that a product was about to be released that was either exactly or a much better version of what I was working on. And of course, for that to happen, that means that product was in development for probably years prior to me thinking about it. But still, there was something about its, you know, imminent emergence that may have gotten it into the atmosphere a little bit.
And I've heard, or I've had other artist friends say that they, for a period of time, want to just work in solitude and not look at art for, you know, a set period of time, so that they just, you know, are producing art from within. And you know, I think about that, and I think, can that really work? Because, of course, we're all, the danger of that is that if we're not informed about what's happening in our field, then it's very like we're still going to have these subliminal influences from the whole society and the world. There's a really good chance that we'll create a whole body of work and think we're totally original, only to find out that somebody did it 50 years ago or 40 years ago or whatever.
There's also a question that I've had of why is it considered better to be entirely, you know, there's, when I went to art school in the 60s, it was what I call the cult of originality.
Right.
You basically had to do something nobody had ever done before, and that was good, even if it was like,
even if it was
not
bad.
Good art, you know, it's just like, but it was unique. And so
why did
was,
all you graduate students, all of work look the same all over the United States when you were trying to
question,
do that?
But, and whereas people like Picasso, Cezanne, all of those people were borrowing from each other and from other cultures constantly. And that was considered a good thing to do. And Picasso said even if you made an exact copy of somebody else's work, it would be original because your consciousness would be in it. So I kind of like the idea of everybody borrowing and inspiring and influencing each other. There's some
right, and as you say, that's what happens. There's really no way to stop it. But yes, it does seem like, I don't know if it was an anomaly in the 20th century, or for a certain part of the 20th century, that originality seemed to be revered above all other aspects of art. And yeah, I mean, I think sometimes to the disadvantage to art, you know, because just being original in itself is not really a valid reason to produce art.
You know, now I think everybody's done just about everything they could possibly do on the horizontal exploration of things you can do. So now this thing is like almost a moot point of trying to be original.
Yeah, it's kind of a postmodern entropy.
So we have to figure out what is the, I talk a lot about this, what is actual art content? Art content has to do with diving below the surface to these more universal places. And this is where we are, have these universal connections, where somebody can be hiding in his studio, trying to draw from deep within some, you know, deep cognition that he wants to get at, while somebody in another studio is tuning into that same cognition because mm-hmm. we're more connected mm-hmm. at that level.
It also has a lot to do with how you see the actual field that you're relating to, because if you just start dabbling with electronic music, you'll quickly learn that 95% of what's out there nowadays is easily done in your first hour of experimenting with a synthesizer. But then there are artists and musicians and sculptors and other creative people who are working with sound, who are doing things that are much, much, much subtler than that. But even so, to the inexperienced listener at first glance, they may all sound like things I've heard before. And I can remember as a child going into the Metropolitan Museum of Art and seeing 1,000 paintings and thinking, well, they all look like those old paintings. They didn't look like any paintings I ever saw at home. They didn't look like anything I ever saw anywhere else except in the Met. And so they had a weird, homogeneity just by virtue of my, not knowing them at all, not knowing mm-hmm. what to look for.
And we have to work out of a tradition. You can't not work out of an already formed tradition. Yeah. So, what are we going to, if you're, we carry with us, the fact that we paint on easels or on the wall with paints and stuff. So there's nothing wrong with that. That's a nice tradition. And now that we have the tradition of abstract sculpture and found object and all of this, we're all working out of those traditions. So it's sort of like, that's not what it's all about. This originality thing really has kind of gone haywire in the 20th century.
Right. And a few years, or some many years ago actually, when I first started working with materials like aluminum screen or found metal materials like that, it often seemed so original. And then, I realized that in the world of fiber art, materials like that are totally common. I think, well, does that mean, I'm not very original? And then I think, well, no, for a fiber artist, aluminum screen is just like paint is for a painter. It's just an available material that has certain qualities, and of course many artists that work in textile techniques will gravitate toward that particular material. It's a beautiful, malleable material, and you do different things with it. And so many people are working in unusual materials now that they're no longer unusual. But I think that what I do and what artists do that work with salvaged or found materials is the same thing that artists and craftsmen have done since the beginning of time. As you look around you and, centuries ago it was reed or grasses or clay or whatever you used to make, your art objects with, and now it's just what we find in our environment, and that often happens to be something from the urban environment for artists now.
Do you scavenge your materials, or do you at this point, or do you have like suppliers where you kind of buy them new?
Both. I just get what I like. I mean, if I see a material and if I can salvage it, many times I've done that. You can go to a metal scrap yard and get absolutely wonderful materials. Or if it's something I really like there are pieces in this show that will be made from hog panels, the heavy welded metal panels that, are used in agriculture that are cut and bent. And then those are wrapped in aluminum ribbon that's made from these dryer duct tubes. And those are not something that I could probably find in large amounts, so I do have to buy those. And people give me things. People used to give me, I could easily fill up a huge space with what, with what people will often give me or bring me or say they've got in their garage if I'd like to come and pick it up.
So when somebody gives you a big pile of some kind of material, is it like Michelangelo, who said he kind of saw the form in the marble, where, like, do you look at it and kind of
I saw
have
the virgin
an idea?
And the dark.
Or how do you go from this pile of material to what you're going to make out of it?
Well, sometimes it can sit around for years. And sometimes I'm absolutely in love with the material and I cannot make it work. Because I love the material so much that somehow I just can't make it work into an art object. So it all depends. But no, I rarely actually see a piece when I see a mass of some type of material. Almost always, it's a process of really just playing with the material. Mm. And I think that again is what I got from the children. You know, that I used to teach. Children get more creative the younger they get. Mm-hmm. You know, at about third grade, it starts going downhill, their creativity. But, you know, just that element of play, and that's usually how I attack a mound of wire or something, is just to start to play with it. And so it does, the material itself drives the creation of the work in many ways.
That's great. And I love that. I love the story of how it was the children and the school that started you off in working in these materials. That's a fantastic story. And before we end, I just wanted to tell the listening audience again that we've been talking to Judy Bales, wonderful fiber artist who is having a show opening at Icon Gallery on August 1st. We have 1 minute left. Anything?
Well, I would just have to pipe in again on this children's thing. You can learn more about creativity by watching children under the age of 10 and under, because they will explore. I mean, I've not taught, I always teach the ones that are ready to learn fine art and to draw and like that, but I finally worked with some 10-year-olds, 9-year-olds, and they've taught me everything about just being creative. They'll find everything in the room is available to be creative with. And I've just let them go rather than say, oh, no, you can't do that. And it's been fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, I guess there'll be a little more music at
the end of this show. How much
well, we stopped
time did
about
we have?
We had about 20 seconds.
Oh, that's what the two fingers meant?
That's what.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.